the significance of this, Susanna Serkin, and what Physicians for Human Rights is calling for now?
Well, we're now calling for, first of all, protection of the site and protection of any witnesses in Afghanistan and elsewhere who may have information. And we're calling for, and I'm beginning to get a response to this request, a thorough, transparent investigation by the U.S. government into who was on the ground, who was there at the site, who was there at the time that the prisoners were loaded up, and who was there and knew something and watched and perhaps maybe had any engagement in the suffocation and killing by a gunshot of these apparently more than 1,000 prisoners who had surrendered, and what the U.S. Did in response to legitimate requests that they investigate everything to do with this massacre.
Also, the witnesses killed. Can you talk briefly about this that Jamie Duran documented? Talking to witnesses that were then killed, some of them tortured, for revealing this.
Yes, Physicians for Human Rights and the United Nations heard these reports and actually documented through other witnesses that several individuals were executed, disappeared, and tortured. People who knew about the incident or who were present. What is extremely disturbing is that we've now seen through the FOIA response that the U.S. government and apparently intelligence agency, it's a three-letter word that's redacted of an intelligence branch of the U.S. government in the FOIA, they knew and reported that eyewitnesses to this massacre had been killed and tortured. So there are clearly risks as we speak, and that's why Physicians for Human Rights is calling for an immediate protection and securing of the site, as well as protection of the witnesses by President Karzai and anyone else who is in a position to provide that protection.
James Risen, one more time, the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, turning to a U.S. general or demanding an investigation of this right at the time or soon after this happened and being turned down. You mentioned this earlier.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, what I don't was not given the identity of the military commander that they talked to. It was described as a military commander in the U.S.-led coalition, not necessarily an American. But it was, I think, fairly soon after the incident. And the way it was described to me was they got zero response from the military commander.
And we're,
if I could just add one other point.
We have 10 seconds.
Just one. Oh, I was just going to say something. I think it's still, it's very unclear what U.S. personnel knew at the time, and I think the investigation should focus rather on what happened afterwards in the Bush administration.
James Risen of the New York Times, Susanna Serkin of Physicians for Human Rights, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Their guest is Reverend Say Koo.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or radiocab.net.
Babies need breast milk. Currently, U.S. milk banks cannot meet the need for donor milk. The closest milk bank to Portland is in San Jose, California. Oregon and Washington have two of the highest breastfeeding rates in the United States, with the potential to have sufficient breast milk donors to serve infants throughout the Northwest region and other parts of the U.S. Monday, July 13th at 11:30 a.m., Anna Keith Soderberg interviews Dixie Wetzel, member of the Northwest Mother's Milk Bank. Listen in to Family Business to hear about the importance of breast milk for us all.
KBOO is proud to sponsor the 30th anniversary of the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee on Sunday, July 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. In 1979, PCASC was founded in solidarity with the revolutionary movement of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. 30 years later, PCASC continues to fight for justice and resisting U.S. intervention in Latin America. The PCASC 30th anniversary event will include food, music, and a new documentary about PCASC's history. That's the 30th anniversary of PCASC, Sunday, July 19th at Liberty Hall, 311 North Ivy Street in Portland. Tickets and information available online at PCASC.net. That's PCASC.net.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott.
My name is Celeste Carey, and today is
Monday,
July 13th,
2009.
Indeed it is. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, in the Valley, 100.7, and on the web, KBOO.FM. More talk radio here.
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
This is Reverend Sekou. How are you?
Good morning, Reverend Sekou. How are you today?
I'm holding on.
Okay. Well, can we get you to hold on just for a moment so we can introduce you properly to our listeners here?
Oh, you're too kind.
Joining us this morning is the Reverend Sekou, who is currently serving as the pastor of Lemuel Haynes Congregational UCC Church in Jamaica, New York. He is an extensive writer and activist. He has organized clergy against the war in Iraq. Following the Hurricane Katrina, he moved to Katrina to help organize communities down there and has continued his activism in many ways. He is a foremost writer and has been noted as one of the clearest thinkers of his generation. Most recently, he is the author of a provocatively titled article, which is in the Killing the Buddha website, and it is entitled, we didn't say how we're going to, can we say, can we?
Might as well just break it on down, because that's part of, that is part of the contention for some folks, I think.
Okay. The title of your article is Gays Are the New Niggers?
Yes.
Okay. And and this is an article that the Reverend Sekou wrote that is part of an ongoing discussion about within the progressive communities about the relationship among oppressed groups. He has highlighted in this article the tensions between the black religious community and the LGBT communities. Today, we hope to discuss the history about the alliance building and the role of religion as both an oppressive and liberating force. And so we welcome you, Reverend Sekou, and thank you for taking the time to join with us this morning.
You are too kind. I just want to just thank you for being courageous enough to engage in a rare activity on the American airways in the midst of a media conglomerate that seeks to sanctify the empire. And so that rare commitment to truth-telling is something that we celebrate and is ultimately the salvation of the democracy. So thank both of you all.
Well, thank you. And also, before we launch into the program, I want to thank you and encourage you not to forget the Lower Ninth Ward. I've been to New Orleans twice for rebuilding efforts, and the Lower Ninth Ward, when I was there in January of this year, still needed a lot of help. So if
folks
who are willing to go down and organize, you know, they should not be forgotten.
No question at all. When I lived in New Orleans, as you know, founding the Interfaith Worker Justice Center, and it became quite clear to me the level of ineptness on the part of our government, as well as faith-based institution, in their capacity to struggle to move beyond charity and to work in solidarity.
Well, actually, let's use this as a jumping-off place. The challenges faced by the Lower Ninth Ward, basically because you're working with a community that is almost 100% black, not totally, but almost, and very poor, and not able to access many aspects that we all take for granted for having lived in an urbanized, we'll call it democracy. In many ways, points to the failings, as you said, of our government and of our institutions. And I find that when one wants to be an advocate for this group, you find yourself tilting at a lot of large windmills. What were some of the experiences that you encountered down in Louisiana that helped shape your consciousness that went into this article? Because I know there's going to be some analogous points.
Well, I think we are in a situation whereby folks the same forces, right, that allowed Hurricane Trina to happen, right? So these same kind of forces, what we in religion would call a spirit, a zeitgeist, if you will, what King referred to as materialism, the triple evils of materialism, militarism, and materialism, militarism, and poverty, his great triple threats of evil, right, that these represent a kind of spiritual angst that has been unleashed on the nation vis-a-vis those who are preoccupied with gaining wealth. And so the same forces that would deny gay marriage are the same forces that will allow the Ninth Ward to be flooded and then privatized, are the same forces that will support the war in Iraq, the war on the people in Iraq. And so part of what our capacity of the struggle is to speak in a kind of theological and a political, if not existential, way about the ways in which these various forces of oppression coalesce in such a way that they oppress us all, balkanize us all, and then have the various forces fighting for crime. So it is the worst, if you will, of a kind of divide and conquer.
And talk about the balkanization. In the article, Gays Are the New Niggers, I think it's appropriate that you focus on Bayard Rustin as symbolic, but also as as a way in which we can begin to deal with different levels and ways of oppression. Tell us something more about the man by Rustin for those who are unfamiliar and his work, not only in the civil rights movement, but his whole history in terms of activism.
Well, Bayat represented one of the was the leading nonviolent organizer among African Americans for the first half of the 20th century. He raised a Quaker by his deep Quaker grandmother, although she participated, she was an AME. In his home, folks came through like W.E.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson, and so he was nurtured in a kind of environment that was quite profound, prophetic, and cutting edge. Early on, he knew he was gay, and his grandmother supported him in that. He went on to work with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, the leading peace interfaith peace organization in the country at the time, and was dispatched in 1947 to do the first Freedom Ride, and then dispatched in 1955 to Montgomery in order to seize upon this moment. And for at this moment, it is interesting, King, nonviolence was a political tactic, but not a way of life. So when Bayard arrives in Montgomery, there are men around him protecting him with guns. And so soon after, it became more of a way of life. And Bayard has this wonderful phrase where he talks about African-American social protest and Gandhian nonviolence. It's like jazz. And so with this kind of profound organizing, and though his sexuality was often an issue where he was often, you know, dismissed from positions, resigned, asked to not be as visible, he continued to organize. He wrote the initial founding documents of the SCLC, raised most of the money initially, and then went on to organize the March on Washington, which ended 15 minutes ahead of schedule, that he was just that organized. And it's interesting, the speech almost didn't wind up on prime time because it was moving so quickly. He was so efficient. And so King's, we almost didn't hear King's speech because he was so efficient.
Now, about Bayard Rustin and his relationship with King, much has been written, but also he was a target of character assassination and had a love-hate relationship, if not with Dr. King, certainly with other black ministers.
Well, yes, no question. He always supported, loved, and cared for King, and King always sought his advice, even privately. The main character assassination had to do with an instance where he was arrested in Pasadena having sex in a car with two men. And as a result of that, he wound up resigning from the FOR, and which was, you know, A.J. Mussey, profound organizer, deeply religious conservative man. And so as a result of that, he resigned, and that came back to haunt him. And in 1960, when King and is planning to organize a protest at the 1960 Democratic Convention, the Democratic Party dispatches Adam Clayton Powell, and Adam Clayton Powell says he's going to manufacture a sexual love relationship between King and Bayard if he didn't call off the march. And so King relented, both out of his homophobia, as well as King was experiencing a lot of exposure around his own extramarital affairs. And so he experienced these assassinations, but while at the same time, he was always the go-to man. So King, Bayard did not initially support the Poor People's Campaign. He thought it was too widely focused, it was ill-advised, and it needed a greater tactical focus. But when King was murdered in Memphis, August 5th, Bayard Rustin is dispatched to Memphis to organize a march with Coretta Scott King, and he later was brought on to organize the failed Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C., and because of his disorganization, he shortly thereafter resigned.
Now, I do want to add a couple of other challenges, one of those being from Strom Thurmond. Having a dyslexic moment here. Strom Thurmond's assertions of his being a communist as well as being gay as being a challenge to the efficacy of his of Rustin's efforts with King.
Well, he was a communist. He had belonged to the Young Communist League. There's no question about that. He had communist affiliations. I think that it is part of the discourse of the part and parcel of that discourse around the Red Scare, in which people were preoccupied with the Great Red Menace. Now, let's be clear.
Well, not just that, but just a new way of casting him, or another way, I should say, of casting him as other.
Well, oh, no question. I think we were, I think the reality is that casting that dispersion was because it was within a context, right, mm-hmm. of the Red Scare. And so a communist, a homosexual, if you will, are all part of a deviant othered class. And so it was extending that. Now, the reality is that the first integrated institution in the U.S., organizational-wise, was the Communist Party. That the Communist Party ultimately provided a certain level of commitment and efficacy and resources to the black freedom struggle. Stanley Livingston and others supported King's work. And so communists were always present. They were not necessarily those who had the deepest allegiance to the Soviet Union, but they believed in a democratic control of economic resources and felt that American capitalism was gone awry. And so
surprisingly, it had a toehold.
Huh?
I said, and surprisingly, had a good toehold in the South and the poor rural black and white communities.
That's right. Robin D.G. Kelly's wonderful book, The Hammer and the Hoe, where it looks at communists in Alabama. And so the Communist Party presented an economic alternative for African Americans. And then when you look at the Socialist Party, Eugene Debs' running mate in 1919 is a preacher, George Washington Woolby. He was the pastor of Mount Zion Baptist Church in San Diego, California. And so these elements of leftist, socialist, communist forces are present in the black community. They take on a different kind of form in the faith and when connected to and spoken to and touched by a black religious identity, black cultural identity. And so all of that is in the milieu as it relates to the question of Bayard's political participation. And then we are clear that Strom Thurmond is not a moral agent on questions of race, class, gender, and oppression.
Oh, most definitely. But one of the reasons I bring that up is because in your article, one of the things that you talk about is how the cohesion of the black community during this time and the assertion of the rights as full citizens in the U.S. Kind of quote-unquote queered democracy for the U.S. Mm-hmm. and then cast a different light, as you'd said, on how we were attempting to get our rights instead of seen as being citizens looking for our rights, when issues such as Rustin's sexuality or his having been communist were brought up, it made all of our assertions to be full citizens seem somehow less legitimate, less valid.
Well, I am making an argument that black bodies queering democracy, right? That I'm arguing that the reality is that
it made it different.
That when I say queers, I mm-hmm. mean that they queered democracy. Those who are at odds with the democracy is what
right.
I mean by queer.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that they are at odds. That they are searching for certain democratic rights. And so the argument that I'm making, oftentimes, that one of the things that people push back against is that, you know, when queer folks appropriate the African-American freedom struggle as a model for the civil rights movement. And I'm saying we appropriated what we got. Mm-hmm. Right. So that we appropriated both the biblical narrative and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution to include ourselves. So Ron Daniels used this wonderful phrase. We heard those words. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And we stretched the Constitution to include ourselves. We read the biblical narrative with a hermeneutic of suspicion where it said, slaves, be obedient to your masters. And we responded, before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. Right. And so we appropriated what we have. And so appropriation allowed black folks to get where they are and to protect and save the democracy for everyone. So it makes sense that queers would want to appropriate that. So they're not doing anything that black people didn't do. Equally, everywhere I have been in the world, they sing our songs. Well, I was in Mexico City with Catholics for a Free Choice in a van with a group of 18 feminist Latina theologians and practitioners who are doing reproductive justice work in Latin America. And they said, we love your songs. So I'm thinking they're talking about 50, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They said, no. This little light of mine, we shall overcome. we shall overcome. When I was in Paris in November 2005, I'm standing next to Mohammed in Saint-Denis. He's setting a car on fire. And I ask him, what do you want? He says, fraternité, liberté, égalitaire, we shall overcome. Everywhere I have been in the world, outside of Stonewall, they sang, we shall overcome, and on that fateful day, June 29, 1969. And so our music has been a model. Our gift to the world, black people's gift to the world, has been our song, our struggle that we've done with elegance, dignity, and pride, and gracefulness, and that gift was given to us as we seized upon the democratic language and the liberatory text of the biblical narrative. It is not ours to own. We are not the sole possessors of it, and it is ours to give to the world. And when we possess it in such a way, when we hoard it, when we try to keep it, when we try to deny other people access what we are given, we abandon our moral obligation, our ethical commitment, and our prophetic role inside the democracy. And the democracy is ultimately crippled, and our movement is ultimately cheapened.
We're speaking this morning with the Reverend Osachifo Uhuru-Sekou, who is the author of an article in Killing the Buddha, Gays Are the New Niggers. He has written extensively and has organized throughout the nation. As you talked about how it's appropriate for freedom movements throughout the world to borrow and share with one another, I suppose one of the issues that is raised by your article is not only the ability for a struggling people to share their liberation with other struggling people, but also whether or not a group has the right to appropriate a movement without either acknowledging or recognizing their own complicity in oppression. So some of the arguments or some of the debate within certain circles, or it's not whether it's appropriate to appropriate certain liberation themes, but whether or not you also acknowledge your own complicity in the oppression of others. And so that's some of the arguments I think that some people have with some of the white queer movement.
Well, I think they're very right. Bayard has, in that wonderful essay of which I'm building upon, The New Niggers Are Gays, makes a profound comment about do you think a world that denies children the right to eat, that denies them food? Do you think a movement that will take away Social Security will allow gays to marry, right? And so the issue is that there are those forces within the queer movement that are preoccupied with middle-class sensibilities and the reproduction of heteronormative, white heteronormative, if not, one could argue, patriarchal constructs of what the family looks like. We are just like you. We want to be married. And I am saying this is not a bad thing. I am not arguing against it. But what I am saying is that they have participated in the repression and the struggle of other folks. One of the issues that vis-a-vis white gay male privilege, they have not ever experienced defeat. Right, mm-hmm. They can negotiate their sexuality in public space, or people ignored it, or they were able to have access to a certain kind of resources. And this is not to downplay being alienated by family. I'm not arguing that queer folks are not oppressed, that gay white men are not catching a particular kind of hell. But vis-a-vis the certain, those who are the wealthy among that class, right, have never experienced defeat. And so the defeat that they experienced around Proposition 8 and the 32 other states that prevent, in various forms, gay adoption, gay marriage, and that kind of thing, is that they don't know what to do, right? So I was watching on CNN when they announced the Prop 8 decision, right? All these people outside the courthouse, thousands of them out there, when they came out, made the announcement, the crowd disperses. They just left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a commitment to organizing, if you were serious about the African-American religious tradition, there was supposed to be a plan in place, and that you go immediately into nonviolent direct action. Mm-hmm. All 3,000 of them should have been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
But what are you willing to sacrifice? It is the same question I pose to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender person, I pose to white folks, I pose to oppressed people, I pose to black folks, is what are you willing to sacrifice? How are you willing to link yourself to the broader project of freedom? Are you willing to engage in a kind of struggle that allows you to wrestle with what it means to be fully human? And ultimately, are you in solidarity with the most vulnerable? So I say to the gay brothers, the gay wealthy gay brothers, where are the least of these in your project? Right? So
indeed,
it is not enough simply to repeal don't ask, don't tell in the military. I want to do away with
the
American empire. The American Empire bases all over the world. What are we going to say about that? Will gay brothers and sisters come and stand in solidarity against a war in Iraq, a potential war in Iran, and an amorphous war on the people of Pakistan and Afghanistan? Will they stand in opposition to the war? When the police shoot a black baby in the back in New York City, would a queen show up? Would they have their flags on and be there in the presence in such a way and says they have killed another human being? Black men are subject to arbitrary violence. This is wrong. It is not necessarily my issue, but I'm going to stand with them. Not only am I going to stand with them because of it is the right thing to do, but it is my respect and commitment to the black freedom struggle that has created the context for me to even conceive the possibility of having full civil rights in this country. And so I think you're very right in raising that criticism, and we have to be equally critical across the board with gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender persons and organizing, as well as internal contradictions around the black community.
Well, Reverend Sekou, I want to challenge some of what's been said, and I want to challenge it along with Reverend Irene Monroe, who you also referenced in your article. But we do have a caller on board, and so I'm going to throw out the phone number, speak with our caller, and we'll come back and we'll visit the challenge to that, because I believe one of the reasons you had a lack of planning and a lack of meaningful activity is because it has been, as you mentioned, immorally appropriated. And I'll answer what I mean by that here in just a moment. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. I'm Celeste. I'm here with Cecil. Join in the conversation with us at 503-231-8187. And you may have questions for Reverend Sekou about whether this is appropriation or this is appropriate. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning, Celeste and Cecil. How kind of you to take my call. And Reverend Sekou has a brilliant, brilliant analysis of this situation, I think. But I'm posing the question, and that is, can there be any correlation between, I'm a gay white guy, but not wealthy, which I'm not ashamed of, it's just the way it is. But the issue of self-respect, and also the corollary, or the other side of that coin, which is self-loathing. I grew up in the 1970s and 80s in a time where, and mind you, the empire goes further. The part of the American empire, it seems to me, is Hollywood and Madison Avenue, and an expression in the country of how gay people should loathe themselves, and they do. They fall into that trap. But is self-loathing a part of what today, a part of this comparison, and can we make it self-respect in a new and exciting way? Thanks for this exquisite program, and thanks for the brilliance of your guest.
Well, you're too kind, dear brother. I want to just thank you for your kind words. I think the reality is around the question of how have black people, in the face of a system that has told them that their hair is too nappy, their lips are too big, that they are only made for sexual reproduction, that their bodies are subject to arbitrary violence within the framework of the American empire, that their labor is exploited, that they can't, their music is a jungle. Is jungleistic, if you will. They can't gather too many of them in the same spaces, right? That a president cannot show any rage, because if he gets angry as a black man, he is immediately an angry black man, right? And so how have these people, in the face of all of this denigration and hatred of who they were in the earth, come to stand with dignity and elegance? I don't know. My grandmother was in possession of that, and I attempt to learn from it and model it, if not mimic it, at moments in our lives. And so I think the question of self-respect and self-loathing is a critical space beyond our own personal pain, agony, and despair, beyond what it means to come out of the particular families that we've come out of, not of our own choosing, beyond the circumstances, not of our own choosing. The question of self-respect is that I'm going to be a kind of human being that commits myself to a story bigger than myself, older than myself, and be able to wrestle in profound ways about what it means to be fully human and to grasp that in such a way. For me, I get some of that out of the biblical narrative that I am a guardian of a particular tradition. And so as a guardian of a particular tradition, the prophetic African-American religious tradition, that I gain it from there, that there are ways in which we sing, we dance, we pose, if you will, the way we dress. I've been wearing suits since for 34 years now. I'm 38 because there was a certain dignity that was given to me in the rural South. And so I think that there is something that can be learned from all people in possession of that. Now, let me be clear. Black folks are not in sole possession of these questions, that we don't have a monopoly on this discourse. But what I am saying is that because of racism, we have not paid critical, and this is inside the black community and outside of the black community, mm-hmm. that we have not used African-American religious experience, cultural identity, cultural production as at least a primary or a primary source for the way in which we come to understand what it means to be human, what it comes to mean to be self-respecting, what it comes to mean to expand a democracy. And so my challenge to all of us inside and outside the black community is to look critical at grandmother and what does she have to say about this moment and how can she impact the quality of our lives and to make us a little better than we were when we got here.
We're speaking this morning with the Reverend Osagyefo Uhuru Sekou, the author of the forthcoming book, God, Gays, and Guns, Religion and the Future of Democracy.
Now, to return to a question that I had earlier, one of the things that was stated was that the group disbanded after hearing the bad news from Proposition 8, that the cause had been lost without looking toward the next step in terms of either organizing or recognizing what where their allies could be. And you said, well, what was the sacrifice? And so what I look at is something that was raised by Reverend Irene Monroe, again, who you referenced in your article, that gay is not the new black. The immediate reaction upon hearing the news of the exit polls, which falsely stated that blacks were the reason that the proposition had lost, that the black vote was the tipping point, so to speak, what was sacrificed was the potential relationship with the black community by immediately blaming and launching into attacks on the black community. And so my concern is, in addressing the black community's moral obligation to let go of cohesive and pointed means of prevailing for rights, that any group that wants to appropriate them needs to have the appropriate moral position in recognizing that everybody is human and start from there. And well, that's what I think could be the main failing of the community when it tries to appropriate the identity and the essence of the struggle.
Well, intention is not to flatten the discourse around internal contradictions to the gay movement. So
right,
that is not
right,
my
right.
intention. I'm not
mm-hmm.
trying to obscure that, and I am not arguing that gay is the new black. I'm arguing that gays are the new niggers, that they are subject to a form of arbitrary violence. That they are in public discourse, while we have had certain levels of tampered racist discourse, some tampered discourse. I'm not saying that they're not Don Imuses. I'm not saying that the police in New York City don't shoot black babies in the back. I'm not saying any of that. But that what I am arguing, I think I say explicitly, is that the contemporary experience of gay folks, particularly over the last 9 months, has ushered them into the community of niggers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying to them that you need to look at yourself as a nigger, as a person subject to arbitrary violence that is hated for who you are, and then look at those who've experienced that nigger, what Cornel West calls the niggerization of America vis-a-vis 9/11, where white folks are subject to arbitrary violence, hated and hunt for who they are, this experience of the niggerization of queers. Then in the face of that, what does it when black folks were niggerized, they produced spirituals, the blues, jazz, hip-hop. They produced Martin Luther King, Benjamin Mays, Mordecai Johnson, Audre Lorde, the eloquent James Baldwin, right? So in the midst of that niggerization, they produced a kind of eloquence that ultimately saved the democracy. So I'm saying the gay folks, can you, in the midst of that, you need to come sit at grandmother's feet. hear what she has to say, that you can also participate in your own image and way, the production of African-American freedom struggle, so that we can extend the rights of gays. So, and I also want to be clear, the forces that deny gay marriage are the same forces that support Wall Street bailouts, and that if we don't stand in solidarity with whoever is catching hell, we lose our moral agency. And so I'm not arguing that they're new black. I'm not arguing that their struggle is the same of ours, but there's some certain existential identification that needs to be dealt with. And I'm not trying to support the life chance. I am not trying to create a space where gay black, where gay Republicans can get married but then vote against universal health care. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that this is part and parcel of a broader freedom struggle that is a theological discourse that is about, that is predicated on Matthew 25:35. So wherever people are catching hell, grandmama said, I got to show up. Gay folk catching hell, I got to show up. Now I'm gonna go get Pookie out of jail when the police come after him. I'm going to fight back against police brutality in the same way, in the same vigor. In fact, my entire career, for the most part, has been on the ground in the ghetto serving the most vulnerable, where my politics on queers may not necessarily fly. But I'm going to say to Pookie, Little Man, and Ray Ray that Twan, the gay musician, has just as much right to be human, has just as much right to have access to democratic opportunity, and that they're a part and parcel of what I read out of Matthew 25:35.
Let's shift the conversation a little bit in terms of looking within the black community. Oftentimes, the conversations around queers and blacks, is there seem to be one group missing, those who are black and queer.
Okay, thank you. So
a question I have is the role of gay and lesbian black people in the struggle for liberation within the black freedom struggle and within the queer movement itself. Are there spaces for that, for them?
Oh, no question. They've always been there. Audre Lorde, Bayard Rustin, James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
What are black people without them? What is the democracy without them?
And if that's the case, then I guess I have a question for the black religious community. And I think in terms of making space for them and for their voices to be heard. One thing I think I heard you and who can appropriate the black freedom movement? I think I heard you speak at some time where you analyzed the black civil rights movement. And you said, you know, we have a way of looking back fondly of, you know, 30, 40 years ago and thought that every black church was a part of the movement in Selma or Montgomery. That wasn't the case. And so there's a need for prophetic black religious folks to speak out for freedom. Are there voices there? And what is your challenge to the traditional black religious leadership?
Hello? Okay, I think we've got a...
Temporarily, we lost connection
with our guest here, and we'll have to prevail upon engineering to get him back. Okay, and in the meantime...
We've been speaking this morning with the Reverend Osagyefo Ohuru Sekou, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Gods, Gays, and Guns, Religion in the Future of Democracy. We've been speaking this morning on the black and gay freedom struggles. Hopefully we have him back online. We do not.
Uh-oh.
We have a caller. We'll go to our caller in the meantime.
While engineering is trying to recover our guest there. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, good. You were raising the question about who can appropriate the black freedom struggle. And I think that appropriation of the black freedom struggle has to do with the way in which, we come to understand what it means to be fully human. And so if gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender persons who are in our community, so let's be clear that in the black church, in particular, there is a normative stereotype that the choir director is gay. That's just a normative stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it reproduced in black cultural productions, say like Tyler Perry plays and those kinds of plays, where there is a gay hairdresser who's deeply religious. Sometimes at the end of the film, he's no longer gay, but whatever the case may be. That if we look at black, if we look at black religious production and cultural production, we see this normative stereotype displaying itself often. And so I even argue that black queer directing is a queer aesthetic. The snapping of the fingers, the rolling of the neck, the holding the choir singing the same note for 15 minutes and walking out into the vestibule while the choir still holding a note. One can argue that this is a queer aesthetic, that gay folks in the participation of the black musical production with our gay organists, our gay piano players, in the midst of all of that, right, what we wind up having is that one of the essential features inside of black worship tradition, right, black preaching, black, what Du Bois calls the frenzy in black music, that one of the trinities of black worship includes a queer aesthetic of black choir directing. And we'll go to a church where the preacher can't preach as long as they can sing. And so I think that this is a reality for us. So it's not about where black and gay, lesbian, and bisexual folks can participate. It is honoring what is always happening. So it is beyond an evangelical mode where one talks about we want to go and bring the gays in. Well, they're already there. They're already at work inside of our community. I'm a child of the black church, right? I am third generation Church of God in Christ. I was raised in this denomination. And I'm an ordained elder. I have no memory.
Hello?
I have no memory of not having a gay black man in my life.
Mm-hmm.
No memory. Always been some, you know, 40-year-old with a quote-unquote roommate living in the Midwest. You know, we don't do roommates in the Midwest because the rent's so cheap. You understand what I'm saying? So
yes.
You know, what grandmama called his special friend.
Okay, so let's broaden it then, because one of the things Cecil had asked Reverend Sekou was, where is the prominence of black gays within this whole movement that seeks to appropriate the struggle but does not appropriate a lot of the moral authority that comes with it by making sure that it's got faces of color in prominent places?
Well, I'm saying, let's be clear, religious identity, that one, queer folks have been hurt by the church. Like, let's begin. That black religious institutions, in particular, have done a horrible job on the full embodiment of their gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender members. We've done a piss-poor job. Religion in general does a piss-poor job on honoring the body vis-a-vis Paul's Cartesian dichotomy of the flesh and the spirit. So we've done a bad job on that. Equally, this idea that they can't appropriate the black freedom struggle, the vast majority of black people in the civil rights movement are appropriating the black freedom struggle. 125 black churches in Montgomery, about 12 participate in the movement, 500 black churches in Birmingham, in Bombingham, 9 of them participate in the movement. And so this idea that everybody over 40 marched with King, so the discourse itself is an appropriated discourse where the vast majority of black people didn't sacrifice a goddamn thing for.
Ooh.
And so I think the reality for us then is that it's not about they can't appropriate our struggle. We got what we got because there was a prophetic few, just a few of them.
Okay, caller, we got to be radio friendly here. One of the things that's really significant, as you mentioned, is you've got a broad chasm here that has to be crossed, not only for blacks to the church and church to blacks, but also from the gay white community to blacks. Because if I'm hearing you right, we've got what is not only a cycle of hurt, but a couple of layers of hurt.
Exactly.
And then also the fact that people seem to feel it's okay to appropriate the struggle, because even within our groups ourselves, we're appropriating the struggle without paying dues. So
I agree. I think, again, as the pastor of a black church inside the black community, right, where we have not done a good job on these questions, I think we have to raise it critically. And so the question I have to consistently ask myself, right, is Sekou, who is catching hell? What is my responsibility in serving them? How do I take seriously Matthew 25:35? And so I feel like that While I agree with Reverend and respect Reverend Monroe, as well as my dear brother Jonathan Walters, Reverend Dr. Jonathan Walters' critique of, you know, gay is not the new black, I don't want to spend a significant amount of time of laying out all those contradictions about what they've done wrong. I want to figure out what do we do to save the democracy.
Okay.
That's what I want to spend my time on. I want to spend my time on, you're right, they are wrong. I don't spend a lot of time with them. I'm trying to figure out, right, because gay marriage may not necessarily be the issue internal to the black community, right? It's mm-hmm. a significant issue. I think the queer community may have made a mistake in letting that be the first focus. Now, I, as a straight heterosexual male, you know, I say that with a bit of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, maybe that shouldn't have been the issue. But, I, you know, strategically, we don't know. But I have some concerns and considerations about that. But I do want to say that if one is going to be serious about what I believe the Christian ethic is, when I was hungry, you fed me not. When I was naked, you clothed me not. When I was sick, you visited me not. Mm-hmm. But if I am serious about this Palestinian Jew named Jesus, the incarnation of God's love in the earth, then I got an obligation to try to say something for these folks on their behalf. And so, again, on the question of appropriation, we appropriated what we got. And so I actually think the appropriation argument is really a non-starter. Thomas Jefferson did not intend for me to be a free black man.
Point taken. Point taken. So just really briefly here, we're looking for a signal from our engineer. One point where people can build a coalition. Where people can build a coalition, an honorable way of connecting.
I believe it has to do with showing up.
Okay, so you agree with Reverend Sekou. Be present in each other's struggles.
We got to show up.
Okay.
Just show up. So my thing, so I'm a bit embarrassed. I'm getting my car towed, and so I'm getting in the...
Okay.
And so I'm sorry there's so much noise.
Oh, that's okay. We want to thank you so much for your call, and thank you for calling again. Call again.
I think that I think it begins with showing up. So I often say when the police shoot a black baby in the back, does the queer community show up?
Okay.
So that was my challenge. Like, where was the queer community on Sean Bell?
Mm-hmm.
Right. That. So you just show up.
Okay.
Be present. That means, you know, there have been in church basements all over this country, there are grandmothers who are working against police brutality. Just show up and sit at grandmother's feet. Let her get a little sweet potato pie and some potato salad and watch her do her thing with her. Sometimes she just sits there and be quiet in her eloquent silence.
Mm.
And so I think it's really a matter of showing up. And willing to do the hard work. So, for instance, inside the Church of God in Christ, although I'm not pastor denomination, I'm still the special assistant to the bishop for New York.
Mm-hmm.
They don't agree with my queer politics, right? They don't. But they always say, baby, we trust you, and we know you love us, because when Pookie got in jail, you went and got him. So the pastoral call is to show up at other aspects and in inside of other struggles that people's lives are experiencing. And so I just, you know, to be prophetic, there must be proximity. So how close are you to the problem?
Well, you know, we've had an interesting experience here. We thought we had lost you.
Oh.
And then we thought we had another eloquent caller, so we're just rolling with the caller while our engineer has been trying to reach you in vain. Now we realize, due to your eloquence, that we have you. Okay, well, Cecil.
So in terms of the challenges to the black church, and so often you hear it seems so popular now to bash gay people. Why does that occur, and what can change within our community?
I'm so sorry, brother. All this truck is so loud, I couldn't hear your question. Could you tell me again?
Okay, within the black religious community, a lot of times you hear from the pulpit attacks upon gay and lesbian folks. How do we work within our religious community to change those attitudes?
Well, I think there has to be some hard theological work. Part of it has to do with, I think, a number of forces. And, you know, I often tell this story. My grandmother used to do offering strikes.
Mm.
So pastor say something wrong about young folks, she'd tap her purse. Women wouldn't put no money in. Next Sunday, pastor got a divine revelation from the Lord that he would need to change his mind on what he thinks about young people. So I think there has to be a categorical organizing inside of churches to push back and to have some opposition. I think there needs to be a profound theological work, and I think that theological work is around biblical literacy and the question of this, what I refer to as the hermeneutic of suspicion. And that hermeneutic of suspicion is that we look at the text with a kind of suspicion, and we ignore anything that doesn't affirm our humanity. So slaves, be obedient to your masters. Women, be silent in the church. My grandmama got around both of them. And so I think those are two elements that we have to, two ways that we can engage in that. But you have to, the reality is that the vast majority of religious institutions are right-wing, reactionary, and conservative. That the most of, all the Pew studies show that the more religious you are, the more conservative you are. The more, the more you go to church, the more you support torture. And so I think that is just the nature of religion. And we're talking about a small slice of religion, right? We ran the numbers on Birmingham and Montgomery.
Right.
We're talking about a prophetic religion, a religion that sees in itself its essence, its core, its mandate to care for the most vulnerable and to seek the identity of God as being just.
Well,
that is a limited understanding of what it means to be a religious creature that does not necessarily have major currency. So we're going to be small in number, but our impact is always served. So Gandhi is a particular kind of Hindu, cutting against the grain of the vast majority of Hindus in this country. King is a particular kind of Christian, cutting against the grain against the vast majority of religion in his day. You know, just a note, 1958, King has to leave the National Baptist Convention with 2,000 of the clergy that put out because King wants FDLC to be an auxiliary of the National Baptist Convention, but they don't want that to be the case. And so he has to leave with 2,000 other clergy and create the Progressive Baptist Convention. So we're just talking about a particular kind of religion. I'm not sure that all of our churches are going to become queer-friendly. I'm not sure all of them are going to struggle with social justice. There are prophetic preachers who do good work, and then there are preachers who are always cutting deals with politicians in order to get what they believe are the kind of resources necessary for their community.
Well, we want to thank you, Reverend Sekou, and we thank you for continuing our conversations in the midst of your challenges, and we hope to continue our conversation with you at another time when we things are a little bit more settled and continue this very important conversation. We've been speaking with the Reverend Sekou, who is the pastor of Lemuel Haines Congregational UCC Church in New York City, and he is the his new book is entitled God's Gays and Guns, Religion and the Future of Democracy.
Thank you so much, and hopefully next time it won't be so noisy.
Yeah. Okay, but thank you.
And keep on struggling.
All right, you too.
Thank you so much. And we want to thank all of you for listening here, and we wanted to thank our engineer who, you know, things
tirelessly
happen.
And works to keep things rolling.
Keep growing. So we was on a landline with Reverend Sekou. He got cut off, called back on a cell phone, and we somehow continue our conversation. We want to apologize for any inconvenience in this morning's conversation, but we hope that you stayed with us. Let me remind you that coming up this morning is the OMO Variety Hour, How Community Organizing Shaped Obama and His Presidency, and the movie Moles review The Hurt Locker, a film about defusing bombs in Iraq. Air Cascadia will not be heard today. Chris Andre and Liam Delta return tomorrow with news and commentary. At 10, you'll hear a full hour of If You Love This Planet. Helen Caldicott speaks with Professor Lawrence Whitner, an award-winning American historian who has written extensively on peace movement and foreign policy. At 11, Roberta Hall talks with labor organizer Robert Gurley on health and healthcare reform. At 11:30, learn about the importance of breast milk and the need for a milk bank in Portland, all on your listener-sponsored community radio station, KBOO. This has been More Talk Radio with Cecil
and Celeste, and we'll hear you next week.